This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. Census Bureau says the nation's biracial or multiracial population will triple by the year 2060. It's projected to be the fastest growing demographic for the next four decades. But this group is often overlooked. It's not always obvious who is biracial. People make assumptions based on backgrounds of others, often about the backgrounds of others based on appearance. And then there's been not much research done on multiracial demographic. Sarah Gaither is trying to change that. She is a biracial woman. Her father is black. Her mom is white. Her work as a Duke professor is rooted in her experience growing up biracial. She's an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. Sarah Gaither, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you grew up in Sacramento, California. What was that community like?
Growing up in Sacramento was great. It's ranked as one of the more diverse, more integrated cities in California. My two best friends growing up were actually also biracial. So for me, I sort of always felt like I fit in there. It wasn't until I left California later on where I realized I was maybe not quite as normative as I thought I was growing up there.
Well, tell us about your parents.
So my parents, they met actually on the bus. So my dad was a bus driver in Sacramento, and my mom was one of his regular passengers. And one day he worked up the nerve to actually ask her out, and here I am, 33 years later or so. My parents have always really valued the fact that they're in an interracial relationship, and they were always raising me and my younger brother to make sure we were really aware of the fact that we were lots of different things. So I think growing up being aware of the fact that they're treated in different ways based on their skin color has really motivated me for what I study today.
What kind of reaction did they get from their families?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story in that when they got married and then when they decided to have kids, both of their families are people, uncles, cousins, things of that sort, which my parents had agreed my brother and I would never meet since they were very against the fact that they were interracial marrying. This was still a new time. They got married in 1979. I was born in 84. And so they made this choice as parents to protect me and my brother from some of the more negative attitudes about interracial marriage. But my grandmother on my dad's side, she was very light-skinned, could pass as white. And so she actually viewed my dad as, quote-unquote, marrying up in society, she always told me growing up. So I think she was excited that he would have someone in his life to help them navigate the social world in easier ways by having a white person as part of his family construct.
Well, talk about this social world. I'm going to make some assumptions here. If your mother is riding the bus and your father is driving a bus, we're talking about people with a working class background. Am I right about that?
Yep.
Where it may be more difficult to accept this kind of thing, less difficult, or it didn't matter?
Yeah, I think it's pretty mixed, actually. And in California, there's one of the larger mixed race populations in California. So I think in general, that state's a little more accepting than other states are in the U.S. At the time, when they first started dating, they actually were pseudo, I'd like to call them fake experimental psychologists like myself. And they would try out different types of restaurants based on how expensive or how inexpensive they were to see where they were treated better. And what they ended up finding was that they were bothered the least in slightly more expensive restaurants versus slightly less expensive restaurants. I'm sure people still had negative attitudes, but they just outwardly weren't verbally attacked or assaulted as much in slightly medium to higher income restaurants. That was their own experience.
You went to a predominantly white private school. Tell us about that.
Yes, I went to a private school in Sacramento pretty much my entire life from kindergarten through 12th grade. So they call us a lifer is the term they give us. But my graduating class was only 35 students. So very small class context. And I was pretty much as black as they came. And for any of you who don't know what I look like listening right now, I'm pretty white on the outside. So it was very aware to all the kids growing up there that my dad, when he would pick me up from school, didn't physically match me. Since he was a bus driver for the city, he often showed up in his bus uniform. So students at this expensive private school assumed he was my hired chauffeur rather than my father. So it was those types of experiences across my childhood that really shaped the fact that people assume that if we don't physically match someone, we can't possibly be the offspring of them.
When you heard that, when a fellow student would make that assumption to you, what would you say?
I called a lot of students dumb back in the day because I really just didn't understand my norm, right? My life growing up was my family all looked different. I was raised by black and white grandparents on both sides. I was constantly exposed to people of all different skin tones and skin shades. So to me, I really was just confused, I think, most of my early childhood, trying to figure out why other kids in my class couldn't accept the fact that some people in my family look different than I do.
When you're talking about not accepting, I mean, it's one thing, okay, for another child, a third grader or something, just to make that assumption, and then you correct them. What was their reaction to that?
Yeah, I think most of the time they had never met or seen a black person before. So I think a lot of this stems from my interest in what I study now, right? This question of exposure. If they've never seen a black person before, if my dad was the first one, it's not really any of these kids' fault, right? On sort of, well, what is this person? Who is this person? How is he connected to this student in my class? So they oftentimes would push back and say he couldn't be my father because I didn't match him. And I think the first time I remember my first racist experience was in second grade when I brought a black Barbie doll to school and a little girl in my class had told me she couldn't possibly be a Barbie because of her dark skin. And this to me was just ludicrous. I just couldn't understand why there were such these fixed views about who Barbie could even be. And my teacher, she didn't really know how to respond as a way for training the class, right? And so her response was for us to watch Reading Rainbow every Friday to expose us to LeVar Burton, who's an African-American male. I'm not sure that was the best response, but it was at least something.
Well, that does, I mean, it raises that question. Obviously, the kids sort of not at fault. And on the one hand, you talk about matching. That's the thing we want to do. We want to match up everything, and it doesn't, and it's a disconnect, and figuring that out. But to what extent did you detect that there was, in their minds already, a sense of hierarchy, that this would be less, that you would somehow not be worthy as a friend or something if what you said to them was true?
Yeah, I think it was instances like that with my Barbie doll that those were the first times I really realized maybe there was a hierarchy, right? Because, I mean, growing up in my family, I didn't think that my white family versus my black family was better or worse than each other. Right. They were just my family. So it really was these experiences from my classmates, the teacher trying to drastically figure out some way to expose these kids to one other black individual besides my father at the time, right? That it made me aware that maybe there were different rankings and different likings and dislikings of groups in our society. And it's that social category knowledge that I think kids learn really easy. And usually that's through their own experiences.
Right. And at such an early age that it all goes uncritically evaluated. So there it is. And you're walking around with it. You had even more stark and dramatic experiences when you went through the mall with your father.
Yes. So walking around the mall or really anywhere, parks, when your skin doesn't match the skin of someone who's walking around a young child, the assumption was that I was being kidnapped by my father all the time. People would walk up to me and say, hey, little girl, like, do you know this man? Or do you feel safe with this man? Is he your friend? And again, as a kid, it's very confusing when you're a 5-year-old constantly getting random people from society walking up to you and questioning not only who you are, but who your father is and who your family is. And I don't think as a 5-year-old we really understand what it means to be biracial or any kind of racial or ethnic identity in general. And so it just adds to the confusion that we know a lot of biracial people face, particularly as young kids.
Well, how would your father react to that?
I mean, he tried to, you know, not conform to the quote-unquote angry black man stereotype, right? I mean, there's this game that a lot of people of color have to play in our society and making sure they don't conform to certain stereotypes. And he was my father, my biological father, so he would usually let me respond first because usually I actually had a stronger voice in some of those situations as a 5-year-old than he did as a full-grown black man in our society. And if my words didn't help, then he would chime in and say, here's my driver's license to show that I have the same name that she's saying, et cetera, et cetera.
And you're also setting up a theme that will follow us throughout this conversation, which is the complexity of having to deal. If you're a minority in this system, how many identities you have to have, even if you are fully African-American or fully Hispanic, the idea that you have to navigate this system in very careful ways is an important thing for all of us to keep in mind. And then, of course, if you're navigating identities, multiple identities, it becomes even more complicated. How did your parents talk about this at home?
So I think it wasn't until I started having these types of experiences that I really started getting socializing about what to do when a kid says, is this your dad or is this doll not Barbie, et cetera, et cetera. They tried to prepare me to stick up for what I believe in. And I think I've always been someone who speaks up more than the average quote unquote woman in our society for that reason. They always told me to speak my mind, speak my truth, and to be proud of who I am. They let me identify how I wanted to identify, which I think was really important. And that's a question I get all the time. How should I raise my kids if they're biracial? What should I do? What should I not do? And I think for me, I grew up in such a supportive household where I knew I was all these different racial and ethnic backgrounds. To be proud of that fact was really how I got through my various identity transitions across childhood and adolescence.
Now, that was within that household, but of course, they each came from their own families. Did you track different identities, that the white family was different than the black family? Was that something that you had to be conscious of?
Yeah, I mean, they behaved in different ways, right? I mean, I always loved going out to dinner with the black side of my family. We were like the loud side of the family. We went to certain types of restaurants, right, where we could be louder. And the white side of my family was also really fun in other ways, but they were definitely not as loud when we went out to restaurants. So, I mean, conforming to these stereotypes, I hate saying this on the air, but there are those different types of cultural experiences, right? I've also been told I gesture and use my hands more than I'm supposed to when I talk, which is something I'm studying now to sort of show what are the communication differences that blacks versus whites have that create some of these differences in how it is we talk to each other.
Were you conscious of the fact that you were acting differently within these two groups?
Yeah, I think sometimes I was conscious. I definitely, when you go into certain contexts and you realize I'm the only white-looking person in a black room or the only black person internally, but I look white in a black room, those kinds of contexts made me more and less aware of my behavior, but really more from an identity angle. So maybe like I felt like I needed to sort of prove my blackness in certain contexts just because I look so white, for example. Versus in all white context, speaking about diversity issues, I think I actually felt much more confident in being able to talk about those experiences. And that's really carried over into my professor position now, where I can speak in certain spaces more easily than others. But I do have this unique angle, this unique credibility in being a biracial person who studies biracial experiences.
We'll talk about those experiences, both personal and professional, when my conversation continues with Sarah Gaither, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Her experience as a black, white, biracial woman has certainly had a big influence on her work, and we'll talk more about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, continuing our conversation with Sarah Gaither, an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke, a biracial woman. Her mother is white, father is black. Her conversations with her parents about identity and how others perceive the family started at a young age, and this early awareness of identity and privilege influenced her to study these issues as an adult. Talk about your brother, because he is doesn't look like you as much. And so tell me again about his experiences and how you've talked to him about those.
Yeah. So my younger brother, Adam, he's about 2.5 years younger than I am. And I remember when he was born, I really didn't want to be a big sister. And I sort of joked once we both got a little older that he kind of stole my racial identity because he looked more racially mixed than I did. He had an afro. He had darker skin, although I actually tan more easily than he does, ironically enough. So we compete when we go on vacations places. But he also, you know, had to be socialized about experiencing certain things in his life that I was never going to experience, right? Because he had more Afrocentric features or, you know, black nose, black lips, and black looking hair. Even though his skin was lighter, he clearly was going to be experiencing things like getting pulled over while driving, followed in stores. And so my dad would have more conversations with him about those types of issues that I never had. And so for me, that was a little difficult growing up as a kid, just knowing he was sort of getting quote unquote extra attention. But it was extra attention to prepare him for things that I fortunately, right, I was privileged to never have to experience. And so for me, it was some of those issues growing up, but he and I are still very close to this day.
And has he experienced those things that your father warned him about?
He definitely has, and he's really been kind of a unique motivating piece for my own work now, because he represents how malleable these experiences are. So it's not like he's always treated badly in every single context or situation, but there are clearly some mindsets, some types of people, some types of situations that shift worse and better treatment. And so I actually use his experiences to inform a lot of the stuff I study now.
Tell me more about your grandmother, and because you talked about her, your father's mother, in a sense, seeing your dad as having married up, that this would be a privilege for you. What was your relationship with her?
So my grandmother, she died, grandmother on my dad's side, that is, she died when I was about 10 or 11, but she played a very strong role in raising me with my aunt, also on my dad's side. So my parents left me there for daycare kind of purposes after school, and so I really viewed a lot of my childhood being raised by her and my aunt. And I think that's why some people even think I sound a little Southern now, because they actually talked Southern a little bit, even growing up in California. But she always sort of reminded me about how privileged I was, how easy my life was going to be, and how difficult my life would also be at the same time, having my dad with dark skin. And so she would sort of tell me these in her grandma way, right? Your dad's going to be treated in this way versus that way, but don't worry. With your mom looking white, she'll be able to take you to the store, and she'll be able to take you to school. And this became a reality in that for certain honor school banquets and stuff growing up, my dad had horrible experiences as a black man in our society, being excluded from country clubs and things of that sort, that he actually didn't feel comfortable going to my own honor roll banquets. Mm-hmm. And so my mom ended up playing certain roles in my life, and my dad ended up playing other roles. So my grandma was spot on in predicting how those things were going to occur.
How would that leave you feeling about your own identity? Did this make you think, oh, better identify white?
Yeah, I mean, it was a conflict for me my entire life, because I think internally I've always identified as being blacker than I look on the outside. I strongly claim this biracial or multiracial identity, and yes, I know I'm very privileged and I haven't experienced horrible things that many people in our society unfortunately have to face. But I think growing up, I always wished I looked a little more like my brother. I always wished I looked a little more like how I actually identify. And so this is a new part of the research I'm doing now, and trying to figure out for mixed race people who don't really look like their minority background, how are their experiences different or the same from people who really can physically claim that multiracial identity?
Well, and tell us about the identity of biracial, of a biracial identity. Is it? Is there a thing? And what is it? Because you actually met up with and became part of a biracial group in college.
Yeah. So at UC Berkeley, there is a mixed race group there called Mixed and Swirl. I now actually advise a few events for the Duke Swirl group here. UNC Chapel Hill has a Swirl group as well. So it's exciting to see so many new mixed race student groups. And clearly, this is an identity that I think now is being claimed much more so than even when I was an undergrad in 2003, for example. So you're seeing students being able to claim this identity in more positive ways. But the biracial word isn't necessarily all encompassing of a quote unquote biracial experience, right? So if you are part white, part minority, you're probably going to have a very different identity than if you're two minority backgrounds within the mixed race population. And again, your skin tone and how you look, those are drastically going to impact whether you claim this biracial identity or maybe you only claim one of your identities. And it's that variability that makes it kind of tricky to study.
Well, what about for you growing up? Was biracial a viable identity for you, or did you feel like you had to either pick one or the other or navigate between them?
I think growing up, I really just thought I was lots of different things. I'm not sure I remember a time when I randomly said, oh, I'm biracial. Hey, mom, hey, dad, I'm a biracial kid. I don't remember that happening, but you know, my American Girl dolls, I had a white one, a black one, and a Native American one to make sure they knew I was technically part Native American also. So I think my mindset was I was always multiple things. And I don't think I really claimed this biracial identity until later in high school and then definitely in college once I found more people around me who also sort of claimed this dual identity experience.
And what were they doing? Again, you talked about being part of this Swirl group at Berkeley. I'm trying to imagine if it was a support group talking about the things you have to go through, or a way to forge a multiracial identity and talk about what precisely that might mean, given, as you say, the multiplicity of experiences you might have had.
Yeah, so I think most mixed-race student groups tend to kind of serve both of those functions. A, it's a way for us to meet other people who are also mixed in some way. A lot of students actually don't feel like they fit into their mono-racial or mono-ethnic group on campus. So maybe you're half white, half black, but being a member of just the Black Student Union isn't necessarily reflective of all of your experiences. And so I think part of it is to find like-minded, similar people like many other student groups of color, right, on different university campuses. And the rest is sort of to increase a sense of awareness. So doing different types of events. We helped sponsor a mixed race bone marrow swap kind of thing, where we would actually increase the number of people registered in bone marrow research. So things like that to make us kind of aware of what issues are the mixed race demographic facing and which ones aren't they facing.
And then you get into the most difficult question of all, which is that in a country like ours, where racism plays such an important part in politics and the political and social order, it is a scourge. So concentrating on race becomes the problem. And yet without a strong sense of your own racial identity, particularly as a minority, you can be lost. You have to have some sense of who you are, particularly when you're defined by others. How do you see all of us navigating, and where does the multiracial demographic fit into this kind of a question?
Yeah, so I think we all have, no matter what race we are, we all have this tendency to want to belong to a group. We all have this innate desire to belong to something that's bigger than just ourselves, right? And I think that's one thing that we know the mixed race population struggles with a lot, is that belonging issue. They're never white enough, black enough, Asian enough, Latino enough, whatever the case may be. And so it's that struggle of finding that sense of self, that sense of place. For me, it's, as a researcher, it's interesting in that it wasn't until the year 2000 that the census even allowed mixed race people to mark more than one box. And that's relatively recent history for our demographics and how it is we count this group for various funding and things of that sort. So I think it's we're behind the times in a lot of our sectors, whether it's government, healthcare, education, and then our own research, which is the void I'm trying to fill right now.
Well, part of that, too, is because in some situations there are benefits that accrue, there are changes in services available and all of that. So picking one for some people becomes very important, whether it's ultimately important or even to them or not, right?
Right. And as a biracial person, if you're forced to pick one, that's kind of asking you to also deny the other,
yeah.
Right? So it's sort of this game of, well, if you only give me one choice, should I play the race card game or should I not if you are part white and part minority? Or if you're dual minority, is one of your minority identities going to be more beneficial to you in a given situation or context? And we're doing some new research right now to show the strategic racial passing actually is viewed pretty negatively by most people in society, almost like we're being dishonest, even if on a form we don't have a choice to mark that we're more than one thing. So I think it's this new question we're all going to be struggling with as a society as this group continues to grow.
When did research become interesting to you, or when did you think you might want to research this question?
Yeah, so when I graduated from UC Berkeley, I knew I was interested in trying to study development and identity issues, but I wasn't really sure how. So I became a lab manager at UCLA in the psychology department there. And under the direction of the professor there, I was able to run the first study ever with biracial infants. And so these were 3-month-old, half-white, half-Asian infants, and I compared their face scanning patterns using eye tracking, which is a fancy computer screen that tracks how long infants can look at certain faces. And what we find is that biracial infants actually scan faces slightly more advanced and slightly faster compared to monoracial infants. And this was the first study ever done in psychology research that featured this population. And it was very telling to me at that moment, hey, I could be this person who is studying this group that I'm a member of that clearly no one has ever included to date.
Now, interestingly enough, I guess kids all catch up at a certain point. But what you found was that they were precocious or a little better at this or faster at this at an earlier age. What do you make of that? I mean, is there anything to, what would you conclude or speculate about what that means?
Yeah, so eventually all kids will end up scanning faces the same way, exactly as you said. But what we argued was happening in this work was if you are a biracial kid, these biracial infants were also from two-parent households, importantly to think about. This extra added exposure they got in their home environment kind of created their abilities to scan and distinguish faces faster because they're constantly exposed in their home of a parent one and parent two whose faces look clearly differently. So that added exposure, that diversity contact, right, seems to be shaping their perceptions of race at a slightly faster rate.
And you realize, too, at that point, you did this research, it was interesting to you, then you looked around and find out there's not much else that's being done, right?
Right, yeah. Even today, I would say in the psychology field, there's maybe about 5 or 6 of us total who are actually recruiting biracial populations to study within experimental type of designs.
And so this is interesting, too, for two reasons. Number one, the research on biracial people to talk about that very identity and how that may or may not may be different and the same as the population at large. But also, if you don't have biracial subjects in your research, it does bring into question the value of that for all of us, right?
Right, yeah. So I think for me, the big hole in our research is we've always thought about race as an either-or construct, right? You're either this or that. But the biracial population is this clear example that you can be multiple races at one time. You can belong to multiple groups at one time. And so for me, I try to use this work as a way to push our understandings about identity more broadly, that we actually all have multiple identities, and it shouldn't be this, I'm just a female, not a female scientist, right? So pushing people beyond this binary is something that I'm hoping this work will do.
Well, it's interesting, too, because in a lot of research, medical research, for instance, we're looking at, we understand that biologically, race doesn't mean anything biologically, but socially it does, and it can have health outcomes, it can have big differences in health, so it's not that it doesn't show up medically. But the fact is, when you're trying to measure both biological differences that are in the context of social construction, it becomes even more difficult work. But it seems to me also much more important for that reason.
Right. Yeah. And I think the health question for the biracial demographic is something that's completely understudied. I myself was almost excluded from an osteoporosis study for women, which had nothing to do with my racial background because they didn't know how to categorize my bones for the bone scanning study. So it just shows that our fields across all disciplines just simply don't know how to categorize us.
So what kind of research did you do after that scanning study?
So after that study, that was a study I did as a grad student. I wanted to make some extra money because you never make lots of money as a PhD student. But now I'm really excited to be doing some health-related research with the biracial population here at Duke. And so we have a grant through the Russell Sage Foundation in collaboration with Diana Sanchez at Rutgers University. And we're looking at cortisol responses or stress responses to biracial individuals in the lab. So if we bring a biracial person in and say, oh, you're supposed to be white to be in this study, this kind of direct denial experience we know the biracial population faces, what are the stress markers that have long-stream health consequences, such as increases in depression, anxiety, and other kinds of health factors. So we're in the process of maybe trying to recruit 20 more biracial people here in Durham. So if anyone's out there listening wants to come in, let me know.
And to prove it, you do. You may not have to do what you do, but you carry around a photograph with you, right?
I do, yes. So ever since I applied to undergraduate, actually, I showed up for a Black scholarship interview, not at UC Berkeley, but at another school I will not name, that when I showed up for my Black student interview, they simply told me, oh, the Hispanic interviews are in the other building. And I had no way to prove to this person at that point in time that I really was biologically Black. I had a Black father. And so I've found it easier for my existence to carry around a photo every single day of my life since then.
How often do you find yourself using it?
Pretty often, actually. It's kind of sometimes more of like a party game, though, to be honest, where someone will bring me somewhere and they'll be like, oh, guess what race she is? And you sort of become this trick, right, where I confuse everyone because I physically don't look like what people would expect a biracial Black white person to look like.
You've also done other research on what it's like to identify Black or white. And you've done that by sort of asking people to write about one parent or another and then have communication with a member of one race or another. Tell us about that.
So I try to focus on some of the positive aspects of biracial identity, too. And so what a lot of our work is trying to argue is that if you are biracial or have these multiple identities, this actually leads to what we call identity flexibility, or you're able to cross diverse spaces more easily compared to people from monoracial backgrounds. So we get a biracial Black white person to think either about their white identity or their Black identity and have them talk to either a same race white partner or same race Black partner. And you find that that simple mindset causes those interactions to go much better. But getting someone to think about their white identity and talk to a Black partner, you see more typical cross-race negative interaction outcomes. So it really highlights this malleability of biracial individuals and the fact that they might have an extra tool to help navigate different types of spaces.
But also the importance to us all, whether for good and ill, of creating an identity. And so it really, things do change. If you consider yourself white and you're talking to a Black person, you see. And what are some of the, how do you even know that it doesn't go as well with the cross-racial conversation?
Yeah, so we look at social behavior in a lot of our research. So these are two-person interactions in the lab. Usually there's a interview type of format, and we videotape these interactions. And so we code them for things known as nonverbal behavior. And we know that people can lie pretty easily on forms on how happy they are, how sad they are, how comfortable they are. And so we find that videotaping these cross-race interactions is actually a much more accurate way in knowing how comfortable people are. So I have a team of undergraduates who watch each one of these video clips and code them for the amount of eye contact, how much smiling people do. And it's pretty telling. You find that this usually correlates pretty strongly with how a biracial person actually also self-reports.
But it's interesting because you prep them. They've done some priming and it will change. So it's not like I bring all of my prejudices in the room and those are going to follow me for life. You can prime me by asking me to talk about this side of my family or that side, and you'll get a different outcome.
Right. Just a simple writing task. Even social psychology has shown that just marking a demographic box is enough to shift your mindset from one identity to the other. And so those are the exact types of behavioral outcomes we're trying to measure.
Have we given any thought to how this whole mechanism works, this socialization that allows us, in fact, requires us to identify so strongly with a group? You know, and in some cases leads to the amount of hate and fear that we're seeing, a loathing of the other group because you've identified so strongly with yours. It seems fairly destructive behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think social psychology was founded on this idea of in-groups and out-groups, right? So the original social psychologist was trying to understand how the Holocaust even occurred. Well, how could people hate someone of a certain racial or ethnic group so much without even knowing them, right? So we have this innate tendency to want to protect our groups. And so I think for biracial people, that's where this confusion kind of comes around. Which group would you want to protect more than others? Are there certain contexts that makes one identity more salient than the others or more important than the other? That's why I think they're a great test for this question of what if we do have multiple groups, which I always argue in my work we all do.
Yeah, well, it's probably not hate. What you do when you hate somebody is avoid them. The reason you kill somebody is because you consider them a threat, right? And so somehow you have actually identified so strongly with your group and somebody has told you that that group is going to annihilate yours.
Right.
And that
right.
Somebody generally benefits politically, but the rest of us, because our critical thinking skills aren't that strong.
Well, and I think for mixed race people, right, a lot of them are visually ambiguous, right? You can't really tell what group they belong to. And what psychology research would argue is that we tend to exclude ambiguous people from our group. If there's one drop of something that looks not quite group enough for me, I'm going to be more likely to exclude that person from my group.
So that leads to this question that you've heard in the conversation about multiracial couples, right? When they would counsel on both sides, but what about the children, right?
Right. What about the children? That's the question I get asked. So parents of biracial kids, I do study 3 to 7-year-olds and a lot of my research too, always ask me, how do I raise my kid? What should I do? And the biggest piece of advice I always give parents is to just let your kid identify how they want to identify. I think exposure to both backgrounds is key if you're in that situation. But what we don't know a lot about is for kids growing up in single parent households. If you are a biracial child and you only have one parent around, how do their identities differ, perhaps? Do they still have the same types of identity flexibility? It's those types of questions that I think we need to start considering.
Talking today to Sarah Gaither, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. She is biracial, and it has certainly guided some of her work. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about how you do this kind of work when you're so closely associated. All of that when our conversation with Sarah Gaither continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Sarah Gaither today, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. She studies the biracial demographic, finished her undergrad studies. She managed a lab at UCLA. She there designed a study on biracial infants. We talked about that and, of course, influenced by her own experiences as a biracial woman. Tell us about, we've talked about the flexibility and the malleability of racial identity when you come from two backgrounds like this. You've actually done some research on this and how it affects creativity.
Yeah, so we did a pretty exciting study where I wanted to see, could the same identity flexibility linked to race also impact other things besides just how you navigate diverse spaces? Is this a broader effect? And so we recruited a large sample of multiracial participants, any kind of mixed race person, as long as they claimed that identity, and reminding them about that multiracial identity versus not actually showed that they were much more creative on a variety of problem-solving abilities. So again, this identity flexibility seems to also be more flexible in their thought processes too. And we've also extended this now to 6 and 7-year-old kids using the same exact paradigm.
And again, did you say that you remind them of this? In other words, does that have an impact, sort of remembering and priming you to think of yourself as biracial?
Yep, it's a simple mindset switch. So if I say, write about all of your racial identities and what it means to you, what it means to be a multiracial person, versus just write about your average day, those were our two conditions that we used. Again, getting those people to think about their multiple identities actually caused this boost in creative responses.
We live in a country where our first black president was, in fact, half black and half white, multiracial himself, biracial himself, and we identify him, or he identified himself, as a black man. And you've done some research on that and how we perceive him pre and post presidency.
Yeah, so I always viewed former President Barack Obama as a biracial president, as someone from that group, and I worked on part of his campaign even, and I was shocked that there were no Obamas for biracials for Obama t-shirts. There was nurses for Obama, blacks for Obama, but never a biracials for Obama, even though he has an entire book about being a biracial man. And so during his reelection, I wanted to see, for those people who thought he was black versus biracial, did that perception change after he was reelected? So there's this common effect in psychology known as berging, or basking in reflective glory. So when your team wins, you're going to claim that team much more strongly versus when they lose. And that's exactly what we end up finding regarding former President Barack Obama, that after his reelection, whites actually thought he was much more white and blacks actually thought he was much more black versus before the election. Whites thought he was too black and blacks thought he was too white. So again, this shift for people who can belong to multiple categories, at least in the political spectrum.
But the one category that didn't get a boost was the biracial category.
Right. No one really thinks of him as a biracial president other than I think most biracial people in the U.S.
You've done some research on how biracial children and adults categorize racially mixed faces, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm really interested in this question of how it is and when it is we categorize a mixed race person more often as white versus black versus Asian. And so what we know from a lot of adult research is that if you see a mixed race black-white face, white adults are going to be more likely to categorize that person as black or as a minority group member. But we have some new work showing that for non-white adults, they're actually more likely to categorize those faces as white, as a different outgroup, right? And so you find these different shifts, again, on the status of your own group, who it is you belong to. And interestingly enough, for both biracial kids and biracial adults, they're not showing a bias in these categorization outcomes. They're at what we call chance levels in psychology research. So they're equally likely to see a mixed race face as either black or white, showing again that growing up in diverse households, diverse spaces, maybe is reducing some of these biases we learn through our society and how fixed to think about these socially constructed categories like race.
And we really need to pick. I mean, it's a binary. It's not just that we have racial hierarchies. We really are attached to binaries. Pick one, right?
Right, yeah. So most of the research would force the participant to say, is this face white or black? Other research has shown if you do remind people that the multiracial category is an option, people will use it. But it's what we call cognitively inaccessible. So when you ask people to list races, most people are not naturally going to think of the biracial group as a category.
And if it looks less like you and there's only one other category, then you put it into other.
Right. So this bias, again, that if you look ambiguous, we're going to be more likely to use that ambiguous feature and categorize them more often as an outgroup member.
How do you choose to identify, or when do you choose to identify yourself as biracial, and when do you not? When do you not mention it?
I think I always identify as I'm biracial. I mean, it's not a secret. I have family photos in my office. It's on my website, right? It's not something that I keep hidden. But I do think there are certain contexts where it's important for me to say this identity. For example, during certain research talks or faculty talks, particularly when I go to historically black colleges and universities, I think it's important for communities of color to know that I'm not some regular white researcher trying to study diversity issues. I am someone who is reflective of at least some of these groups' experiences, definitely not all of them. But there are definitely certain contexts where I think it's more and less appropriate for me to bring it up.
I wonder if you've ever, throughout your life, at any point, thought it would just be wiser not to say anything. In other words, if I could pass for white, I think I'm just going to do that and not disabuse them of whatever error they've made about my race.
Yeah, I mean, this question of passing has been historically part of U.S. history since the slave trade, right? If you had this ability to pass, you're going to have better life outcomes on average, right? This is what my grandmother told me growing up, with her herself having white or lighter skin. So there are definitely some situations where I wouldn't necessarily outwardly claim my black identity for safety reasons, right? And those were the discussions my parents always made very apparent to me growing up, is you need to make sure that when you do out yourself, when you do disclose certain identities, that it's in a safe space where you're not going to put yourself in danger. So I'm very privileged in that sense to be able to hide this identity if I need to, whereas so many people in our country can never hide those identities.
Has your sense of yourself, your sense of racial identity changed over time, and how so?
I think over time, you know, as a kid, I didn't really, again, claim this word biracial as sort of my identity group. College, I became much more accepting and I think excited about being a member of this biracial demographic. And once I left California for grad school in Boston, I went to Tufts University. Boston had so few interracial relationships there, so few interracial couples. I would get excited when I saw one on the street, that it was that moment I realized, oh, I really am not a normative group in our society. I really am something different. So again, these contexts based on where I'm living have also shifted how much I've sort of positively claimed this identity.
Are you involved in research that you are doing some, I think, in collaboration with researchers in Hawaii in a context where race is a little bit more diverse and a little less binary, right?
Right. Yeah. So I'm doing some work with Kristen Pauker at University of Hawaii Manoa. And what's really interesting about Hawaii is they're already about 30-40% mixed race on the islands of Hawaii. So they're the largest mixed race group in the United States. And what you find there is that these words like hapa, so being of part Asian descent, as they've claimed there, really creates a much more positive environment for mixed race people growing up there. In fact, you find people are less fixed in general in how they think about race compared to U.S. Americans on the mainland. And so it's been really nice to be able to work with her to look at these context effects on not only biracial outcomes and how positively they may feel, but perceptions of biracial people are also very different there.
And then health outcomes. You talked a little bit about the research you're doing. Is there much out there that you're aware of that's already been done, research on health outcomes for biracial people?
There's very little research that's actually targeted a biracial population specifically. What we do know from a lot of clinical health research right now is that they are showing higher rates of mental health problems compared to other racial and ethnic groups right now in our society. So higher rates of depression and anxiety, again, because of this constant struggle of trying to fit into their respective identities. But other than the mental health research, there's very little tangible, I guess, findings for how it is we can expect biracial people to fit into one of their racial disparities versus the other.
It'd be interesting to compare that to what's going on in a place like Hawaii, for instance.
Right, right.
And you are married?
Yes.
You've married a white man?
Yes, he's white.
Did you? Did this have any influence on you or an impact on you? Were you conscious of this when you were dating?
I think I was half conscious and half not. So I married Matt Johnson, and we actually met in undergrad. So we've been together almost 13 years now. So yeah, he's white. I dated people across all different racial and ethnic lines until I met him. And I never think about race as being this predictive factor, though, right? I think, again, because I grew up in this multiple identities kind of environment, I sort of just see people for who they are. But yes, people always ask me, wow, you married a white man. Why didn't you marry a black man? Yeah. And we do have these discussions where family planning, you know, in the next few years, that in theory, our hypothetical non-existent child could pop out looking phenotypically black, and making sure that he's prepared to raise a kid who, again, might not match what we both look like.
However they look, what kind of conversations do you imagine yourself having?
I mean, in theory, the kid would be, you know, a quarter black, right? And so I think there's these questions of, is a quarter black enough to mark that on a form, right? These are questions I get oftentimes from the participants in my lab. If I'm a quarter black or a quarter Asian, is that enough to mark this on a form? So I imagine those types of discussions are going to be pretty prevalent. And a lot of it's going to depend on how the kid looks, right?
Right.
I think this match of identity and appearance is really makes it easier or harder for biracial and mixed race people to claim their various identities.
But then there's contact with the extended family, your mother and father's family, that's likely to happen. And
right, yes. Yeah. So hopefully they will come out to North Carolina and we'll visit them in California. But yeah, the socialization and contact that they're going to have. I mean, a city like Durham, right, is very ethnically diverse and there's a large African-American population here. So I think there's those components, too, that could definitely be playing a role.
What about this? The fact that you're interested in it is obvious. You've grown up this way. You've had your own personal curiosity. So, you know, what a great opportunity to be able to do the research. But do you worry that you're too immersed in it?
Yeah, I worry a lot. And there's a stigma against people who are called me searchers, right? And I'm definitely considered a me searcher because I'm studying my own experiences and people similar to me. And I worry sometimes that I want certain outcomes to happen in my research. And what if I find out something horrible about the biracial group? As a good scientist, I should still release that data, right? No matter what happens. But there are certain types of studies that I think I'm more and less hesitant about running just for fear of finding out something bad about my group. But I think, you know, that's why I have a large team. I have 2 graduate students. I have 21 undergrads who work with me. And so I think from the variety of their angles, I try and get them all to lead their own projects as a way to diversify my approaches.
A lot of people who do kidney research have kidneys.
Right.
So,
right.
You know,
yeah.
It's hard to say. And if you don't, then you have an even greater stake and you get back to the me search. But to what extent can you then inform, though, and ask the kind of questions that someone who is not biracial might not even think of?
Right. So I think being biracial gives me an added sense of credibility, right? I'm sort of a living expert of at least one type of a biracial experience. So I think there are those limitations, right? My own experiences are not reflective of the entire biracial demographic, particularly because I look so white and I haven't experienced certain things. But I do think it gives me a unique perspective to think about these questions of identity flexibility, identity denial, as someone who has experienced some of these things. One of my new graduate students, Brenda Straka, is actually mixed Latina, so I'm really excited to be pushing our work to include the mixed Latino demographic for the first time. That's another group that's been largely excluded from these types of discussions.
Well, and you talked about this before. There are various kinds of combinations, and depending on what the social stratification is in your context, those will be more or less meaningful, right?
Right, yeah. And then there's combinations and intersections with gender, too. So my other new graduate student, Adam Staniland, he's trying to push these questions of identity threat. How do they intersect with gender and race, for example?
Well, that's something we're starting to understand a little better these days, is that gender is also a much more fluid biological function and factor than it is socially. I wonder if there's any way in which they can be brought together, this kind of study, or are you wise to study them separately?
Well, they're both socially constructed constructs, right, to a certain extent. And I've always been interested in trying to compare identity threat experiences between different groups. Are there the same types of responses? And is the same type of identity flexibility present in people who are more or less conforming to what it means to be an ideal man versus an ideal woman, for example? Those types of direct comparisons haven't been done, but I do think that's the direction we need to go in trying to figure out, are these universal identity flexibility outcomes for anyone, or is there something specific to race and something specific to gender, right? Yeah. Considering these binaries do, I think, function in slightly different ways for those 2 types of social categories.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this, but whether we are generally more fearful about ambiguity in one than another.
Right, right. And this question of, you know, being transgender versus transracial, right? There's some new discussions in our society on which one is quote unquote worse. And I don't like playing the oppression Olympics in my research ever,
right.
But there's this question of, is it worse to be transgender or worse to be transracial from a stereotypical angle? And that always leads to very fun debates in my classroom.
Fun debates. And of course, the tragedy of all of this is that the population that you're studying, that gives us less information about that population than it does about the social order that created the pain and suffering that people in these ambiguities have to suffer. And so that's really what you're measuring. How sick are we as a society that forces people into institutions because they can't cope?
Right. Knowing people who are biracial or transgender or anyone who is sort of transitioning or confused about their identities, we're usually confused because of how society is treating us. Right. And so if we weren't so fixed in what groups we think we have to belong to or don't want to belong to, I think we'd all get along a little better.
What have been the big surprises for you along the way?
I think for me, the biggest surprises is just the amount of emails and phone calls and stuff I get after publishing a paper, realizing that I really am setting a group that no one has really focused on before. To me, that's been the most exciting thing, but also the most challenging thing, because I get always a few emails from random people from some subset of the biracial demographic. You're not studying me. I'm trying to get there. It's a slow process. But for me, it's really been that feedback from society.
And of course, you're talking about the people who are aware of it, but here we are in the South, where we know there's a whole lot more racial mixing than is acknowledged in terms of people, you know, checking the box on their pages. There's a lot more fluidity down here than people acknowledge.
Yeah, you would think that, although when I got my North Carolina driver's license and told them I was biracial, the woman taking my license test said, no, you're not. So yeah. I think there's also, you know, again, this exception for if you look biracial or don't look biracial, right?
Well, and how you take it, if you know that what it means to you and how you have to navigate knowing that you're biracial versus not knowing you're biracial, which is sort of fascinating. I mean, biologically, there's no difference, but now you're in a social construction that forces you to think about it and then respond, right?
Right. So if you didn't grow up thinking you were mixed race, but, you know, with 23andMe and Ancestry.com and all these different DNA kits that everyone's doing, people are learning things about their ethnic and racial lineage in new ways. And how does that shape our senses of self and our own identities, right? And that's some new work that's happening across the country.
I was going to ask you, has there been much research on people who've grown up thinking they were one thing and find out that, in fact, there are more than one?
Not a ton. I mean, a lot of that's looked at in adoption research, for example. So maybe you grew up not knowing you were adopted. So that's probably the most similar stuff that's been studied more so. But there's rising work sort of showing if you do get this genetic feedback about what it is you actually are, how much do you believe that genetic feedback and how much does that change your racial biases? And I think there's some new work suggesting there's a conflict, right? That if you don't agree with what genetic you are, really, identity is constructed through our experiences in our environment. So does it even matter what my genetics are? And this, again, gets back to this question of what is race? What is gender? What are these different constructs?
Well, I'm glad you're going to keep working on it. We'll have you back. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having
me. Sarah Gaither, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. And you can find out more about our show and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.